friends, two things to point out before we get underway with this episode. The first is that this is part one of a two-part series with Armin Asadi. It's so good. You will want to hit subscribe and make sure you hear part two. But also to let you know that this episode might not be the best episode for young listeners. So if you've got little ears around you, go ahead and put those earbuds in, as Armin shares very openly about some of the things he experienced as a refugee. So just want to put that disclaimer out there. It's great content. God shows up big. But there's some reality of the hard things that he experienced that might not be suitable for everyone. Bless you. Hit subscribe and get excited. This one's really, really good.
So I want to welcome everyone to the Dare to Believe podcast. I'm here with Rebecca Ribnick.
Hey,
Rebecca.
Christy.
And we are speaking today with Armin Asadi. Hi, Armin.
Hi, Christy. Hi, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm excited to have Armin because his testimony goes on and on and on. You have lived, I don't even know how old you are, Armin.
I don't either.
Okay.
It's 38 or 39. I think 39 now. So.
All right. So, but you have lived an amazing life to this point, and it's just going to get better from here.
Come on.
God willing.
Yes. We declare that over you. And you are married to your beautiful wife, Ashley.
That's right.
And three beautiful girls.
That's right.
And what are their names again?
From oldest to youngest, Ada, Avia, Alma.
And they're beautiful.
They are. It's definitely not after me. They definitely look much, much like their mom.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they look like both of you. And we want to get into all of your story, but first, the girls are miracles.
Yeah, oh, for
so
sure.
So you've been married to Ashley for how many years?
This is so November 11th is our 10-year anniversary, I want to say.
Congratulations.
Wow. Yeah. Nine-year anniversary.
Somewhere nope. around there.
Yeah,
somewhere.
Well, we got married 11-11-11, so.
Yeah. And you were told at one point that you wouldn't be able to have kids.
Well, yeah, not without being extremely intentional, mm-hmm. medications, watching the cycles and timing everything and all that. And when we were trying for our first, I mean, we had a miscarriage of, we miscarried twins.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know, it was
hard.
Yeah, it was an uphill battle. I mean, we have friends that had a lot more challenges than we did. So it definitely gave us perspective. But when we had our first, we were going to Honduras for our missions trip. And on the plane to Honduras, because Ashley went before I did a couple of days, because, you know, I'm the very, very reluctant type to do missions trips. And on the plane, she has ovarian cyst something mm-hmm. disease, and she had a cyst rupture on the plane that was
so
a little
painful.
Bit larger than a golf ball. And I mean, she was on the verge of passing out.
Yeah.
She was sweating, you know, she's excruciating pain.
Yeah.
You know, like not like I have cramps, kind of like I was shot
right.
in
no,
my
yeah,
stomach.
This is a big deal.
Yeah.
Friends have experienced this.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. So you know, yeah, I'm not a woman, so I have no idea, but my wife can tolerate pain. And so when I know she's in that much pain, it's not me with a cold, you know? It's my wife actually having pain means something. She's a North Wisconsin farm girl. That's one tough little lady, right? And so ruptured cyst, they get and, you know, take her to a hospital in Honduras, in Tegucigalpa, which isn't exactly the, you
it's
know.
Not what you would choose, yeah.
First class hospital system or anything like that. And, came back, doctor looked, they're like, yeah, it's definitely a ruptured cyst. And it's pretty much medically impossible for you guys to try to have a baby right now. So let's just focus on healing and not worry about, you know, the whole baby thing. Let's try again in a little bit. 2 weeks later, my wife says, man, I'm having a lot of symptoms that would tell me I'm pregnant. Takes pregnancy test, comes back.
2 weeks later.
2 weeks later, yeah.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Comes back positive and calls the doctor, and doctor is like, eh, that's probably a false positive. Why don't you come in? We'll do the blood test and find out if you really are pregnant. I wouldn't give your hopes up. It is unlikely, to say the least. Goes, blood test. Doctor comes back, literally says, I don't know how, but you're actually pregnant. I'm sure my wife's only word that came out of her mouth at that point was Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, because yeah. that's
how.
That's Ashley.
And now you have three girls later.
Yeah.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
That's good.
That's, yeah, I mean, I just choke up every time I think about my girls, you know. It's I always say I lived life thinking I have seen so much, experienced so much, been to so many places that I thought I knew what the world looked like, you know. And until we had our first daughter, it was quite literally the first time I could see in color, you know.
Wow.
Like it was like I was living life in black and white, monochromatic screen lens, whatever you want to call it. And then, you know, I have a kid, and it was like, oh,
this is life.
I get it. Like it just, everything started making sense. The relationship with God, it was overwhelming to the, I'm not a crier, you know, my wife can attest to that. I'm not an emotional processor by any means, but I would hold her every night to put her to sleep, and I would cry. I wasn't sad. I wasn't upset. You know, I wasn't depressed.
It was deep emotion.
Yeah, it was an unleashing of so much goodness that I didn't even know I could actually perceive, you know.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And, wow. And knowing that that's how God feels about us.
I think that was really a big part of it.
Yeah.
Because you know, when you have a background like me, in the back of my head, there's part of the faith where you accept that you are accepted, that you are loved, that you are redeemed. You know, you can hear enough sermons on it and have enough of those experiences where you accept it, but there's something inside you that doesn't truly believe it, because it's not a thought that says you were I was genuinely a terrible human being, right? Like, and I don't even know if it's appropriate to say this. You guys can edit it, but in my head, my actual words are, sure, that makes sense, but how could he with me? I was such a piece of crap,
yeah.
Right? Those are my actual words that go through my head.
But
all
he's a good God, but he couldn't love me like that.
Yeah, like, you know.
I think a lot of people end up in that place.
And I'm not over it.
That.
Yeah, I'm not over it.
You're in recovery from it.
Yeah, yeah. I still think about it all the time. But until I had my daughter, it was just kind of like, it became a belief. I'll say that.
Mm.
It was a rationale. But once I had my daughter, it truly became something I believed, because I couldn't see myself.
Yeah. Well, you have an understanding of a father's love.
Yeah.
And what does a father's love feel like?
Yeah, and by no means do I want to make this sound like my dad didn't love me. My dad was an awesome dad.
No, but you are experiencing as a father, loving the child. So now you know what it feels like as a father to love someone, and this is how the Lord feels about his kids, even when they're a mess.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and that was... I can't even count the number of times where I would be crying, rocking my little baby. She's already well asleep, you know, but I just didn't want to put her down, so I keep rocking so my wife doesn't make me go to bed and have, you know, because she always says, just put her down, don't rock her to sleep, don't rock her to sleep, because then she's going to get used to it. So she would be well beyond sleeping. I just didn't want to put her down. I'd be rocking. I'd be crying, and I would watch my tears fall on her, and I would just be saying over and over, I get it, God. I get it.
Wow.
I get it, God. I get it.
Wow.
I finally get it.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was life-changing.
And as a father, doing what we do at Dare to Believe with the ministry we do, the wonderful thing that's doing for your daughters,
yeah,
to be loved like that by their father,
yeah,
is powerful.
You guys were a big part of this. I've shared the story many times to many people, but the Sozo experience I had here was, that was life-changing, you know, just from my experiences being born in Iran. And
well, let's tell people what your life experiences were. You're now living in the Twin Cities. That's how we know Armin. He's a Twin Cities person, but life didn't start there.
Right.
So where were you born?
Tehran, Iran. So 1981, born in Tehran, Iran, 2 years after the Islamic Revolution.
What a time to be born there.
Right? Come on, yeah.
Wow.
And in a Baha'i family who is one of the few...
The Baha'i faith.
Yeah. We're a family in the Baha'i faith, and we have some of the deepest roots in the Baha'i faith in the world. My family is one of very, very few families in the world who can connect their lineage all the way back to there was a guy named, everyone laughs when I say his name was Bob, but they called him the Bob, B-A-B. Yeah, it's a true story. For the Baha'i faith, the Bob was kind of the John the Baptist to Jesus. The Bob was John the Baptist to Baha'u'llah, who was the prophet of the Baha'i faith. So there was a small group of people who followed the Bob, same way that there was a small group of people that followed John the Baptist, and they were called, I'm not making this up, the Bobbies.
Feels a little different in right. Non-English language. Yeah.
And my family goes all the way back to the Bobbies, you know.
That's
so
crazy.
Pre-Baha'i faith, we were essentially Baha'is, right? So, and the Baha'is in Iran are considered the stain on Iran because it is a non-Islamic religion founded in Iran, it's a shame to the country. It's a shame to the culture. It's a shame to the Islamic faith. And so imagine Jewish, Nazi, Hitler.
That's how it
that was then. Oh, yeah. We have martyrs in our family, hangings, beheadings. I don't know if we had actually anyone beheaded in our family, but, you know.
It was where you were.
Yeah.
And so your family was able to escape Iran.
Yeah.
Wait.
Yeah. It was... Able to is a good way of saying, because it's a 50-50 toss-up, right? So you basically are saying, stay in the country, risk being caught and executed or imprisoned for life, or...
Because you said anybody that knew you were Baha'i could kill you legally.
Yeah, it's...
It's legal.
Yeah, it's a righteous killing.
Yep.
And there's crazy laws out there. If a woman gets raped, they can stone her for adultery.
In Iran?
Yeah. It's twisted. Yeah, it's not justice in a humane way. It's
right.
Just justice interpreted from a religious perspective, you know.
And so how did your family get out?
It was crazy because, you know.
And you were about 6-7 years old.
When we left, yeah. My family was extremely well off, very, you know, wealthy. My dad, mom both ran banks. And I just, you know, at one point some
military... How did they do that after the Islamic Revolution? Like, how did they hold their positions? Did people not know?
Well, they didn't hold it that long, you know. I mean... My parents, by the time 79 came, I mean, they were extremely established, you know. After the revolution took over, you know, it takes a handful of years before they fully assimilate all of the government into
gotcha.
it, you know.
Gotcha.
So by the time I was 3 or 4 is...
time to go.
Yeah, and that's because, you know, they had actual officials from the military government come and say, hey, here's a piece of paper, sign it. It says you're Muslim and you can keep living life as you are, or you don't sign it and we're going to take your entire life away, including your physical life. And
wow.
My dad refused to lie about his faith, and
wow,
we started living on the run for a good couple of years until there's nowhere else left to run in Iran. And you take a 50-50% chance. You pay these guys on the Iran-Pakistan border to cross you. You know, like the same way Mexicans get crossed into the United States. Yeah. It was the same thing we were doing, but going from U.S. to Mexico, basically. Right? So, yeah, we fled across a desert, climbed a mountain, almost died a few times, almost got caught once, and, you know, it was just pure insanity.
And you're just a little boy.
Yeah, I mean, I had a smoker dad carrying me on his back, you know, and I was tied to him with a, you know, like a bed sheet.
Wow.
And there was parts where I was doing, you know, the walking, climbing and all that, but when we were running across the desert and we could see the border military patrol, you know, and the reason I say it's 50-50 is the people crossing you, they collect money to cross you.
They might double cross you, yeah.
And then they collect money from turning you in,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Wow.
So you really don't know, you know, and we got dropped off a mile short of the mountain because that was our checkpoint. And that was right when we saw the border patrol lights off in the distance, and we were hiding behind tumbleweeds, you know. And I'm strapped to my dad's back, so I can hear him praying, you know.
Wow.
Like, God, not like this, God, not like this, God, not like this. Right? And his voice is shaking, and you know, I can feel his just, you know, I'm tied to his back and I can feel his heart pounding, he's shaking, and it was like, it was just so intense, you can't forget it as a kid,
can't,
you know.
Imagine.
And so I remember that because I remember them talking, as you know, like, did they cross us? Is this it? What do
right.
we do? And so I remember them processing, because I don't really fully grasp what's going on,
right.
You know, because they want to make it sound like a adventure for me.
And at that point, how many people were in your family trying to escape?
With us was, we had sent my sister 2 years prior to us, you know, just, again, they could rape her and kill her for mm-hmm. adultery, right, legally. Lots of things can go wrong with her being a teenage girl. She was 17 when they sent her. So it was just, my dad, mom, my older brother, myself, my aunt, uncle, their 2 kids that were 3 and 5, and, an 18-year-old and 19-year-old teenage guys who were Muslim, but they didn't want to fight in the Iran-Iraq war. And the only way they could get out of being in that war, because, you know, the Iran strategy was throw bodies at them.
Yeah.
Whoever has more bodies will win, basically.
Yeah.
So they're like, I don't want to fight in this war. This sucks. And so the only way they could flee the war is actually leaving the country, because it's either die by the hands of the Iraqi soldiers or die by the hand of the Iranian military leaders.
So you were on the run in Iran for 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And then had to go through this to get out of Iran.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's trauma.
Yeah.
And then you make it to Pakistan. Like,
yeah.
That's
we,
where you are.
Yeah, we go into Karachi, and then we go live in the, you know, the upscale slums.
The upscale slums.
Because there's more than one floor in the clay apartments. And, yeah, I mean, we were there for 17 months, you know, reassimilating to a new culture, new languages, and... But, I mean, I had a great time, so I can't complain.
And you said you enjoyed it.
I loved it. I mean, just flew kites and went to school and played with tops, and you know, everything was some form of gambling. And I don't know, you know, it was
but
fun.
Your family didn't stay there.
No.
Because it wasn't, was it not safe to stay in Pakistan, I assume?
No.
So how did you get from Pakistan to the U.S.?
We just had to wait it out until we got religious refugee pass from the United Nations, mm-hmm. and we figured out which country we were going to go into. You know, we were applying for the United States because we had family here. My sister was here and all that, but we weren't sure if we were going to actually get a chance to come to the United States. And 17 months later, we got the religious refugee pass through the United Nations that we were accepted to come to the United States.
Wow.
And all the money we had, we never spent and kept it, just waiting for that moment, you know, eating peanuts.
Really?
Like literal peanuts, you know, for a meal. And yeah, that was it. Spent the money, came to the United States, went straight to Minneapolis.
Yay.
Yeah, been there.
Wow. And the rest, well, isn't history. You got much more to the story there.
Hey friends, just a quick break to tell you about something so exciting coming up in the year 2021. And that is a 24/7 prayer initiative. Now, many of us are familiar with the idea of a prayer room or a prayer house. We are going to do a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week prayer watch that will continue throughout the year. Practically what that means is you will sign up for a time slot of 1 hour, 1 day a week, and that day, that hour, you will pray for all 52 weeks. We'll send out some guidelines and some things to help get you started, and when your hour is up, you'll pass off the watch to the next person. We truly believe that God is doing an unprecedented thing in this season, and that prayer is the engine that powers it. So we want to invite you to find out more information. Click on Prayer Initiative at dare2believe.info to hear more and to sign up for your slot. This is the season. This is the time. This is the call.
So you lived in Minneapolis in... Mm-hmm. Kind of the Cedar Riverside area, if people are from Minneapolis, knowing that.
Right.
So, and you said it was a big upgrade from the slums of Pakistan.
For sure.
So you lived there from about 8 years old till you were a teenager.
Well, for our non Minnesota residents listeners, that would be Projects, kind of a rough area.
100%.
The Minnesota, like the Minnesota viewpoint, but coming from the Pakistani slums.
Yeah. Golden streets.
Yeah.
Paved roads, cars, parks. You know, there isn't a sketchy, to say the least, graveyard with hands sticking out of the ground. You know, whatever people are worried about in Minneapolis, I was like, pretty sure this is the safest place I've been in a long time.
Yeah, and most Minnesotans wouldn't go there without help, probably.
Yeah,
They wouldn't. They'd think twice anyway.
Oh, for sure.
So you lived there from about 8 years old.
Yeah, we lived there for about a year, and then we moved into Section 8 housing or something like that in North Minneapolis or Northeast Minneapolis, and we lived. I was about 13, and my parents just wanted to get me out of the.
It was an okay life, but you were starting to get connected with people who probably weren't the best influence for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I was surrounded by, you know? It's either have a life or don't have a life, you know? So,
either you have friends or you...
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, we lived in a duplex or a twin home or whatever you would call it, you know, and our neighbors were... you know, they're gangbangers, but they were the only ones close to my age, and that's who I hung out with, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was just a dumb kid following along.
Well, and we were talking about this before we started recording, because what I love is the Lord did give you a lot of gifts, and your parents have a lot of gifts, both bankers. I mean, you're intelligent leaders. And
yeah.
These are gifts you're born with, but you also lived through some crazy stuff, and you learned to survive, and you learned to thrive, despite what was going on. So some of it is God-given gifts. Some of it is talent that you've acquired along the way.
Yeah.
But the enemy to your soul, the enemy to your destiny, saw the talent, right? Yeah. And was pretty busy recruiting you.
Did a great job.
Yes.
Trained me well, too.
Yes. Yeah. You have a real entrepreneur spirit on you, and boy, you put that to work. So tell people what happened next. Your parents moved out of North Minneapolis.
Yeah. We moved to White Bear Lake. So
which,
I went,
for people who aren't in Minnesota, that's a northern suburb from the city. So out of the city into the suburbs.
Very suburbs. Mm-hmm. So I went from being the lightest skin-colored guy in the neighborhood to being the darkest skin-colored guy in the school, the neighborhood, you know. It was strange, you know, because I didn't know I spoke differently than people that lived 20 minutes away from where I lived, you know. I didn't know I dressed differently. You know, you grow up in the hood,
right.
You know, you get a little bit of slang, you say words differently, you know, you have a different walk, a different style, a different posture, but you have no idea it's different because you blend into the culture that you're there originally. So now you have the whole new adaptation process of figuring out, and I kept getting being called ghetto, and I didn't know what that meant.
Oh,
you know, so I was like, "What? I'm ghetto? I thought a ghetto was a place, and, you know." So it was all those different things, and you have to figure it out.
And you're a teenager, which is throw that into the mix. You know?
Yeah, scrawny little teenager, 13-year-old scrawny kid. But it was fun. I mean, you know, I went there, I joined the football team, smallest guy in the team, but you know. Coming out of Iran and Pakistan, you learn not to fear bigger people, you know,
and scrappy.
Yeah, you get a lot of heart. You get, you know, you're not as worried about getting hurt or whatever. And, it wasn't hard to be, I don't know. You kind of come in as an outcast, but when you have a sports that you can get people to appreciate you for who you are. You get adopted into.
Then you have a team.
Yeah.
Your crew. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And that's part of what we were talking about too. You have a personality that does adapt well to people. People, you connect well with people, mm-hmm. And you said part of that's maybe a God-given talent, but part of that is I had to do that to survive.
It is a survival right? instinct. And,
yeah. Yeah.
Because you have to adapt to Muslim culture, not knowing anything about Muslim culture. You have to adapt to. Pakistani culture, not knowing anything about Pakistani
people.
Which is
a different Muslim culture.
Yeah, you got the Sunni Shiite thing, exactly. Coming to Minneapolis, and then going from Minneapolis to White Bear Lake, you know, like every single one of those transitions, it required quite a bit of adaptation because it's not the same. And you're not accepted until you're accepted, you know? So
yeah.
You don't know if you're going to survive until you know you're going to survive.
And so did moving you from North Minneapolis to White Bear Lake accomplish what your parents had hoped and keep you out of trouble?
Yes. But what kind of made the whole situation turn back around was when I was 15, my parents started divorcing. Mm. And Middle Eastern culture, you know, more often than you hear that... the Islamic faith is the religion of the Middle East. I would say that family is the religion of the Middle East.
That's interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Everything is based on the family, even the religious standpoints. So that's why when someone converts out of Islam into a different faith, it's not a shame to the religion. It's you're ashamed to the family. Mm. And I don't know, you grow up having your entire life be just centered on family, family, family. And next thing I know is that everything I'd been living for is being torn apart. Mm. And I honestly had never heard the word divorce until I was 11 years old. I never heard it. I didn't know what it meant. The only reason I found out at 11 is because I would go to my friend's house who he lived with his dad. His mom wasn't there. Mm. And the assumption that you make as a kid growing up in the Middle East is the mom
passed away.
Yeah, or got killed, right? Yeah. So you don't ask. And then one day, his, you know, after school, we're biking around, and all of a sudden he says, oh, my mom's pulling up, hang on, drops his bike, and he's running to a car to go get something from his mom, and the mom drives off. And I was so confused. You know, sure. I've known this guy for 2 years. I've never heard anything about the mom. Now she's dropping something off. What? I was like, what do you, where was she? Where has she been? He's well, at her house. I'm like, what do you mean at her house? What, you know, I was just.
It's a whole new concept.
I couldn't understand it for the life of me. Mm-hmm. And that's when he said, oh, yeah, my parents divorced. And he said so nonchalantly. I was like, what's divorce?
Wow.
No clue, right? Wow. And I thought, what kind of crazy culture is this? Like, why would parents separate from each other? And da-da-da. And then, you know, cast judgment based on very little logic. And, you know, 4 years later, here we are. My parents are going through a divorce. And I didn't even think that was in the realm of possibilities. And, it was that event that kind of brought me back into.
So
old
you
friends.
Were doing really, you were doing well until that point, because your foundation was fell apart.
Mm, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this was an amazing student. I enjoyed school. I hated waking up early, but if
Who
I attended,
doesn't, though?
Yeah. Still. Yeah, if I attended, I did great. You know, I was amazing at taking tests. It wasn't really hard. I've had to learn so many different learning styles from so many different school systems, you know, and coming out of Iran where you get beat by rulers and canes and stuff like that for, you know, being late or not having your nails trimmed or, you know, or not answering a question correctly, you know, like coming into America, it wasn't a challenging school system. It was just challenging learning the language, you know, and culture.
So how many languages do you speak now, Armin?
Well, English was my fifth language, but the irony is I don't remember language 2, 3, and 4 anymore.
Oh, you don't?
No, because I was illiterate.
You haven't used them. Yeah.
And my parents didn't learn because I was constantly translating for them. My brother didn't. I mean, he knew, but not as well as I did. So I had no way of keeping the language. I had no way to talk, can't read, can't write. And there wasn't other people around me that spoke that language.
That
so
makes sense.
I can hear it and I know what they're talking about, but I couldn't reply if I tried. It's
interesting.
Weird.
Wow. Yeah. So then what happened after your parents divorced? What happened in your life?
Well, ironically, they never divorced, but it dragged on for a long time. You know, I was 16 at the time. And, you know, when you're 16, you know everything there is to know about life. And I was sure I did. But I was losing my family. So being the wisest man on earth, I knew I had two options. That was it. There was no other options in the world.
Because you knew.
Yeah, of course. Who knows more than I do? That there's two options for me is kill myself or find a new family.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And there's just something about killing myself that it just, I don't know why. I couldn't do it.
I'm glad.
Yeah, but like to this day, I'm confused by it. You know, like, was it because I don't like blood? Is it because, like, what was it? What, like, of all the things I've seen, I don't.
God wasn't done with you yet, Armin.
Yeah, I mean, something. I don't know. I was so desensitized to death where I just, it's never made sense to me. Why wouldn't I just kill myself? And so I went out in pursuit of a new family, you know. I said, well, if I can't find a new family, then I can kill myself. And that's when I started going back and hanging out with, you know, from the
kids
Minneapolis
from the old
area.
Neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah. And
or young men from and women from the old neighborhood.
Yeah. And, you know, they're all like me, refugees from different countries. None of us were from the same country. You know, you got a guy from Ukraine, a guy from China, a guy from Vietnam, and all of us spoke a minimum of three languages. All of us came from very crazy backgrounds, have seen
things
plenty.
You shouldn't have seen.
Yeah, you know, we've seen mischief, seen violence, seen death, you know, living in an area where people think it's scary, but for all of us, we're like, this is.
And they became your family.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, you take care of each other as 16-year-old's best Ken, and, you know, my job at Taco Bell wasn't exactly the highest paying job, you know, even though I got a promotion by the time I was 16, but
it's Taco Bell.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, you eventually start dabbling into whatever is available to you to make more money, to be more independent. And that's what we did.
And you didn't know the Lord at this point. You're just trying to survive.
I knew Baha'i good, Muslim bad. You know, I was the breath
right.
of
you
my
knew religion,
knowledge. Yeah.
But you didn't know the Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it was just one of those situations where you just do what's right in front of you and you're influenced by the dominant voices, you know, and.
And so how bad did it get for you?
It got good, you know, I got a job at Circuit City and was making the big bucks and, you know, we were dabbling in criminal activities that made some good money and, at that point, just based on money, we thought we had it really good, you know, driving unbelievably nice cars that we shouldn't have had as teenagers and, being able to throw parties that we shouldn't be able to throw and being able to do things and see things that we shouldn't be able to at such a young age and getting more and more respect in the communities and, you know, like there's this mindset that people had towards us where it was like these guys are soldiers, you know, and, you know, all of
it. So you had respect.
Yeah, and it just felt great, you know. Even though the other side of it back home, the thing that we lost, you know, my family, that was so, it was dauntingly painful. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, you find something that even resembles good and you just go all in because you don't want to deal with the catastrophe at home. You know, this at least feels good. Let's keep doing more of this. I want more of this and less of that. You know, and yeah, it spiraled. Good thing became bad quick.
Like in a year and in...
It took a few years.
Okay.
Yeah. We didn't get organized until I was 19, so it took a few years.
And what do you mean by getting organized?
You know, when you're doing criminal activities, more often than not, you're just flying by the seat of your pants. You know, there isn't a whole lot of thought that goes into it or strategy that goes into it. You're not doing it or treating it like a business.
So you begin to have a criminal business plan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you start setting a foundation to, okay, what is it that we do? Who is it that we are? What are the boundaries that we have to play within?
Would you have considered yourself a gang or?
No, not at all. No,
just organized crime.
No, not even that. We didn't, like, nothing. No, we didn't think we were anything.
Okay.
You know, we just, because we knew what the gangs look like.
Okay.
You know, and that's why we couldn't wear red or blue, right? Walking around Minneapolis, because if you're wearing, like, I wore a Bulls, you know, Chicago Bulls outfit once, and my neighbors flipped out. Without exaggerating, they flipped out. Are you trying to get us all shot? Are you trying to get our houses shot up? Go take that. I mean, they were ripping my shirt off of me, you know, because they're like, dude, what are you doing? We're in GD territory and you're sitting here blazing red. Are you stupid? I have no idea, you know, at that time. And so you get adapted to what gangs look like. And we looked nothing like them.
Nothing like that.
And we knew what organized crime was and we looked nothing like them. So we didn't, we just, you know, just thick skin friends.
And at what point did you decide this was not the way you wanted to live your life?
Ten years later. So 16 is when it started.
So you did this for 10 years?
Yeah. I made the ranks. You know, after we did become an organized crime syndicate and we got very big and, you know, we were moving well over $200 million in
very
cash.
Big. That's a lot of money. And you guys are just kids.
Yeah. Yeah, we really were. but it was 26, kind of like, you know, I was the most humble guy in the world, so I decided to throw myself a party to have people celebrate my awesomeness. And, yeah, I mean, there was just this, we had arrived mentality.
Cause,
I
mean, mentality?
We had arrived.
Oh, you had arrived. Know,
like,
sure.
The world is our oyster. Mm-hmm. We had so much money.
And you were successful.
I mean, we had astronomical amounts of money.
Smart and doing business, actually. It wasn't legal business, but it was business.
No, we had legal businesses. We had a lot, you know. And we were self-made, you know. We weren't beholden to any type of criminal organization other than what we created. It's not, you know, everyone always asks, are you Italian mafia? Are you Persian mafia? It's like, no, none of us who've per se founded this organization are the same culture. So we're not Israeli, Russian, Italian, whatever. Like it was impossible. None of us were the same culture. It truly was something where we designed this whole thing. We built the whole thing. We brought in the funds, we brought in the people, we did all of it, you know. So, and we were at the top of the food chain for what we created. And by the age of 26, moving that much money around, having that many people in your organization, having that many assets all around the world, and being that connected and having that much influence, we were God amongst men, you know, in our heads. And obviously compared to other organized crime, we were nothing, you know, we were peons, but for where we are, we were like, mm-hmm. you know, literally we were like, we are gods. and it was just a celebratory event. Spent a ridiculous amount of money to throw this party at a nightclub that we had silent partnership in, you know, and we spent no less than $250,000 just to throw a party.
Wow. Brought at a party.
Just one party for one night, you know, rented out the top floor of a hotel and, you know, had everyone there, which was right next to the nightclub, and we throw this massive party. And it was this moment where, you know, just, and I don't say this to sound like an arrogant jerk or anything like that, but just to set the scene, there's this, you know, bottle of Louis XIII, which at the time was like this $1,300 bottle of cognac, you know, made of crystal bottle. And, you know, and I'm grabbing that bottle and pouring myself a drink, and I'm going to the corner of this VIP area that overlooks the whole club, and it's this big giant red velvet chair, you know, and I'm the king of the world moment.
It's your throne.
Yeah. And so I'm sitting there, I have this drink in my hand across my legs, and I'm just looking out at the crowd, and I ask myself a simple question, you know, and this was an arrogant way, like, how did I get here? You know, I had arrived. I had power, respect, fear, money, blah, 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 blah. You know, the club was just filled with all sorts of anything and everything you could possibly imagine that you would want at a party like that, being a criminal. It was there, you know, Hollywood level movie party. Right. And so I'm trying to soak it up. How did I get here? And then it was funny. I asked the same question again, but with an entirely different tone. It was more curious thing, like, wait, how did I get here? And I started processing it, and it didn't take long, but I remember, oh my gosh, this all started because my parents started divorcing. And the only reason I went down this path is because I was looking for a new family. That's how I got here.
Yeah.
And I started looking around that room, right? Like, these are my people. These are my people. This is my crew. These are the people who, you know, I have been walking down the street and been shot at. We have gone to jail together. We have almost been killed together. Some of them have been shot next to me, you know. I've held my hand on bleeding legs and arms, and you know what I'm like. These are my people. Like, we have gone to war with each other and been in trenches, and you know. And so I'm looking around this group, and I think I was expecting, like, I found my family moment. And I kept looking around the room and making eye contact with different people. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks, you know? I was like, man, this isn't family, you know? This is just, you can tell when people look at you a certain way that you're either family or you're not. And there was something about that moment that revealed to me that this is a bunch of people who are just in it for the money and power, and whoever has the most of it, they're loyal to, you know? Mm-hmm. And the most celebratory moment of my life became quite literally the most depressing moment of my life.
It's kind of like a veil was opened, isn't it? You saw.
It hurt, though.
I bet.
It hurt. It was kind of like a axe to the scalp, you know, like right across the forehead, and it opens your mind in the most painful way, you know. And I remember, I don't think I even set my drink down. I literally just dropped it. I got up. I went to the hotel next door. I went and sat at my bed, and I pulled out a gun that I had in the drawer in the nightstand next to me. And that's all I wanted to do.
Thank you for listening to our Dare to Believe podcast. When I challenge each one of our listeners to dare to believe God for greater things in your life this season.
Amen. We'd also love it if you would subscribe, leave a review, and a 5-star rating, as well as share this with friends, colleagues, whoever would be encouraged by this message. Thank you so much, listeners.